Hi, and thank you so much for checking in for another episode of Millennialism. On today's episode, I talk with my old professor and recent Fulbright Scholar Grant recipient, Dr. Nora Madison. Dr. Madison, or Nora as I'm now allowed to call her, has a PhD in communication, culture, and media from Drexel University in Philly, and she has presented her research all around the world, including an invited talk at Sweden's International Science Festival in 2013. In 2015, she was invited to the White House to participate in a policy briefing focused on the cultural and material needs of the American bisexual community as part of the White House's LGBT initiative under the Obama administration. Nora is currently working on a new book called Everyday Activism, Technologies of Resistance, together with co-author and husband Matthias Klang. And I think the book is scheduled for publication in June next year. She is obviously very smart, and I was very lucky to get some time to discuss some things I've been thinking about with her. We talk about our dependency on technology, social media, and entertainment. We discuss Neil Postman's famous and somewhat controversial book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. But don't worry, having read the book is definitely not a requirement for listening to this conversation. The book is from 1985, so it is a couple of years old, and it's about how television negatively affected public discourse. But I think a lot of the same arguments can be made and can be extended to social media, technology, and its effect on society today. We also discuss social media companies' presence in our lives and their role in shaping public discourse, fake news, how we can be more media literate, and way much more. This was a very interesting conversation, and I'm sure you'll think that too. And if you want to reach out to Nora or read any of her research, you should definitely check out her website, noramadison.net, and also buy her book when it comes out next year. Don't forget to rate, comment, and share this podcast with your family and friends. And with enough support, I'll hopefully never have to start looking for a real job. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this talk with Dr. Nora Madison. All right, welcome to the show, Dr. Nora Madison. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's really a delight, Adam.
Do you want me to keep calling you Dr. Nora Madison, or is Nora fine?
Nora's fine.
Okay, I feel like I've earned that privilege since I now know you. I wanted you to have on today because you are a professor of communication and media studies, and I know you're doing your own research right now. And for the past, for a very long time, I've been very interested in media. Obviously, I'm studying communication. I've had the privilege of having you as my teacher. So I wanted to have an expert on today to talk more about it. So why don't you just start by giving a short introduction about yourself?
Okay, sure. Yes. So I have been an assistant professor now for the last 4.5 years, specifically with Chestnut Hill College, right in Philadelphia. My PhD is actually from an interdisciplinary program at Drexel University, which was communication, culture, and media. And I loved that program. I had a fantastic experience getting my PhD there. And it really helped me develop a lot of skills for thinking across disciplines instead of being siloed within specific frameworks. And so I think that is such an asset when for studying media, because media is so pervasive. So I got my PhD in 2016. And I have been working on social media since.
Yeah, I know you're in Norway right now. You got this incredible grant last year. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is really exciting. Actually, yesterday was my 3-month anniversary living in Bergen, Norway, where I am the Fulbright Scholar in Residence at the Digital Culture Program at the University of Bergen. It is a fantastic program. And again, it's really interdisciplinary. Very few people do exactly what I do. So sharing my research and listening to others has been so helpful and really inspiring for thinking through similar questions, but in completely different ways. I've started my project here, which is going to be examining the aesthetics of protest memes. And when I first sort of imagined this project, I was really interested in both comparing and contrasting American and Scandinavian protest memes. Specifically, I'm looking at climate change and immigration, as those are two incredibly relevant topics in in both places. One of the other things that I was really interested in was looking at how US-centric platforms shape a lot of this discussion, or a lot of the activities, what types of memes, how they get distributed, what gets banned for, you know, violating community standards, and so on and so forth. But interestingly, I've been thrown a little curveball, which is both fun and a little intimidating. And that is that the majority of new activity in terms of protest and memes is really happening on TikTok. And so I find myself diving headfirst into a new social media platform, which of course is a little unfamiliar. You know, there are aspects of it that are of course familiar. It's
I've never used it myself, actually. I've just seen videos on like Instagram and YouTube from the platform.
Right. And they're all so interconnected, the way we cross post. Absolutely. Right. But TikTok is, interestingly, not a US platform. It's a Chinese platform.
And so no idea.
Yeah, right. So it's just gonna it's gonna be a very interesting year, and I've only just begun. So
yeah, how does it work when you're doing research like that? Like, how long do you do the research? Do you do any, I don't know, experimenting is maybe the wrong word, but how does one like conduct research for media?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. There is no one way to conduct research for media. In many ways, there are sort of established methods, and depending on the type of questions you have, it would really shape how you go about doing it. So there's lots of, for instance, there's lots of ethnographic research where people would do what we would call participant observation. You would go in and you would post, you would interact, you would comment, you would become a part of maybe a Facebook group or a YouTube community and see how people construct their messages and discuss it with them as a user. What I'm looking at is more semiotic. I'm looking at the sort of visual and aesthetic elements of a lot of these memes, and I'm interested in the comments, and so I'm sure I'll end up doing a multi-method project, but the one that I'm starting on right now is more semiotic, and so I'm looking at the sort of artifacts, the content themselves. So I just go in like a lurker and I just sort of collect large swaths of memes and create databases. Generally, I tend to use Excel. I tend to use tech light databases because it's just me and I want to be able to move quickly through them. And then I just start the coding process. I just start looking at and analyzing them and making my notes and trying to figure out what I'm starting to see.
What would you say have been the most interesting finding or highlight of your research and academic career so far?
Okay, I'm not sure what the most surprising finding is. Maybe I'll think about that and I'll have an answer for you a little later. But I can tell you what the most, what the sort of most significant part of research has been for me. And that is, it's the sort of organic development of ideas and how they build. And what I mean by that is, for lots of academics, your dissertation is your foray into becoming a professional researcher. Lots of people might have research experience. I certainly did before my PhD. I had worked in public health research for Einstein Hospital for like 7 years. So I had lots of experience doing and conducting research, but it was always with teams. And the PhD is this really, really individual sort of slog through mastery. And what I really love about it is that while I don't necessarily still research specifically the exact questions and groups that I first started with, and my dissertation was focused on bisexual identity and how people use the internet to create and sustain a political bisexual identity. So that was sort of the gist of it. And from that research and from that process, I really came to a conclusion that was so much bigger than my question itself. And that was that I began to understand and see what participants in my study were doing as a form of political activism. But at the very everyday, mundane, daily level. So it wasn't about organized marches and large community efforts. It was about individuals trying to contribute in mass, but individually in very small ways to this idea of sort of creating a larger cultural understanding of a bisexual identity. And so that idea of connecting it to everyday activism, which then led me on a new rabbit hole of learning all the research and all the literature already done on everyday activism and its connection to the larger sort of work on activism in general, shifted my thinking, right? It wasn't what I set out to do, but where it took me was really exciting. And that's actually become the platform for all of my future research since. That's what I've sort of built on, is this idea of really understanding everyday activism in much broader terms and looking for it everywhere.
That's really cool. So about 2 years ago, I think it was, maybe a year and a half ago, I had a class with you. I can't even remember the name of it. Maybe it was media literacy. I think it was media literacy. Anyway, you made us read this book that I have in my hand called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And I remember reading it about, yeah, a year and a half ago or something. I really liked it, but I don't think I read it very deeply because I had so many other classes going on at the same time. But I just reread it last week, and it kind of blew my mind. So, I mean, even though I didn't read it as closely a year and a half ago, I still know it. So you can be happy about that at least. But it's a book about, it's written in 1985 by a guy called Neil Postman. That everyone who studies communication has come across that name. It's about how television has negatively shaped the public discourse or public communication in America. But a lot of the points and arguments that he's trying to make, I think, can be extended to the media and technology today as well. So I kind of wanted to talk to you about that because I know you're an expert on this book. But can you give maybe a better summary of the book just to anyone who hasn't read it?
I think you've done a perfectly fine summary. But first I want to say how delighted I am to hear that you've went back and reread it, because those are the kinds of seeds that every professor loves planting. So
you're welcome.
Yeah, that was just a gift, right? Yeah,
well, I should be thanking you instead, because if it wasn't for that class, I wouldn't have read it now either. So,
well, I like to think maybe this seed is being planted across all these courses, and I love that thought. So, yeah, Amusing Ourselves to Death is a book that I have been using for the past 10 years in teaching. And it's not a perfect book, but my Lord, is it a great and accessible book for starting, I think, a really meaningful conversation about the significance of media and how and focusing on the bigger questions, right? So in Amusing Ourselves to Death, Postman comes in and he wants to jolt us by giving us these two sort of opposing dystopic visions of the future. And he borrows them from well-known literature, right? So he comes in and he says, is the world we're living in shaped like Orwell's 1984, mm-hmm. in which the state, right, is this surveillance culture and and sort of an oppressive surveillance culture where we have no privacy from the state, and we're not only being watched, we're watching ourselves being watched.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, or could it possibly be more like Huxley's Brave New World, where we don't even have a reason anymore to revolt, because we have accepted the conditions of our lives, and we have just decided to amuse ourselves, to keep ourselves in a sort of constant state of contentment through this drug called Soma, right?
Mm-hmm. I actually, just before I read this now, last week, the previous week, I actually read Brave New World for the first time as well. So maybe that was why I was more affected by it.
Yeah, that's actually probably a thing to do.
I highly recommend it, actually. I have not read 1984 yet, but it's next on my list, so
right.
I can compare some ideas.
Right.
But,
so we should all be well informed with our dystopias.
Yeah, for sure. I found an excerpt here from the book to kind of support what you were saying. That is, one claims a totalitarian regime will watch our every move. The other assumes we'll be numb to oblivion with consumerism and drugs. Especially after World War II, Orwell's prediction felt much more likely. So when, in the very same year, it came true, Neil Postman showed up at the world's largest book fair and claimed Huxley was more closer to reality. And I guess that supports what you were saying as well, that for a long time, maybe we thought that our world would become more like Orwell's predictions. But looking back now, especially with the way media has evolved, Huxley's version, dystopian version of the future or our now is more likely.
Well, you know, and I would actually argue that the two are still neck to neck, honestly.
Okay.
And I've just written a paper that I will be presenting next week at the 9th Symposium for Digital Ethics. There we have it. And next week I'm going to be talking about live facial recognition.
Okay.
And after writing that paper, I walked away once again thinking, oh boy, 1984 still rings too close to home, right? Too close to true sometimes. So the two, I think, in some ways, as dystopic futures, still give us, both of them still give us valid concerns,
mm-hmm.
right? Valid reasons to be concerned. But of course, setting up any type of binary opposition does tend to obscure the true nature of the spectrum of things. So all of this is happening within a great big gray scale of userability, of capitalism, of people's fears and hopes, global interconnectivity. So all sorts of other factors play into how we use media, to what extent we use media. But all of these concerns, for as binaristic as they are presented to us, certainly give us lots of fuel for thinking through a lot of the ethics of digital media. Absolutely.
Yeah, I guess maybe I was very impacted by his Huxleyan warning just because I just read Brave New World as well. Because when I read that book, I really recognized some things. It was kind of hard because I read the book, and I was in the book, they take this drug called Soma, as you said, that kind of numbs them into this state of, they're not really happy, but they're just not feeling anything, basically. Mm-hmm. And I could kind of recognize how I use media sometimes in a similar way, that when I'm not really doing anything, I pick up my phone or something to kind of comfort myself from having to face what it is, whatever I'm dealing with, or actually making something, I don't know, productive or maybe better with my time. And it was kind of hard reading that and seeing myself in part of what he's describing in that book. And I could kind of see how a lot of people do the same thing. And it's kind of scary, I guess.
And there's, really fascinating and really worthwhile research coming out of, I'm trying to remember what the field is called, but really looking at the sort of brain chemistry and psychological effects of social media, right? And I tend not to always agree with all of the conclusions drawn from the biomedical studies done with social media. That being said, I think that they are an important and incredibly interesting contribution to the overall conversation that we should be having on the effects and the role of media. And one thing that's really interesting there that you talked about is this sort of this, you could call it, right, the soma effect, the complacency, we are so routinized to reach for our phone, to go onto our favorite apps, and then to even be bored there. So then we're bored together online, right? Yeah. Turkle has a lot to say about this in her work as well. But what I find really interesting about that is that there is some research that suggests we're getting these dopamine hits when we go on and interact with others and get a like on this or that. So the field is all encompassing. It's psychological, it's neurological, it's cultural, it's social. There are just so many elements to thinking about our mediated world.
I just want to get back to the book a little bit more. Another argument that he makes, I'm not exactly sure how to phrase it perfectly, but he kind of argues that since the introduction of television, and I guess even more now maybe, that the TV or public discourse has kind of been dumbed down since the introduction of television. And since technology and the media has evolved so much since he wrote this book. So I just wanted to ask you if you agree with that argument.
I think Postman makes a strong argument. And I think it's incredibly useful for thinking through bigger issues. In his book, he argues that television cannot support the same level of intellectual discourse that the written word can. And that's really his premise there, right? That if we take the typographic mind, which is what he sort of calls it when our culture's primary medium was the book or the written word, right? And that it shaped us to have long explanations for things, to draw them out, to create them chronologically and linearly, and to explain them in long form to one another. And then he argues that television is a audiovisual medium that excites that is meant to excite us in a way, right? It's flashy and you can have many cuts and you can change your scenes from here to here. And he notes early on that he sees one of the major problems with this is when we try to engage in the serious discourse our culture has around things like politics, right? And leadership. And when we try to do it in the format of television, which is in 30-second or maybe 2-minute clips that change quickly and have to sort of fulfill the audiovisual standards of television. And so he says, if you want to go onto television to be entertained, there is no problem with that. It is a great entertainer. But if we're using it as an educator, then we really need to talk very deeply about what types of metaphors, what types of communication the television can sustain, right? And so that's where he says, he follows up on very, very famous and well-known quote by Marshall McLuhan, "The medium is the message," in which McLuhan is saying, please don't focus on the content, focus on the change that the technology introduces into society, into human affairs. And building on that, Postman was in fact McLuhan's student, right? And so building on that, McLuhan says the media is the metaphor, right? Media is too complex and is always in need of interpretation. Therefore, it works metaphorically. And then he takes that idea and ultimately comes to his position of the media is epistemology. And epistemology is just a big, long syllable word that means essentially how we know what we know, how we access what we know. And so he says, when we know things through this format, through this medium, then we know things in small, disconnected, rapid, successive ways. And we no longer have the linear and sort of long, drawn out explanation of things. And so that's why he argues that it's making us dumber, because we're not spending time explaining or being engrossed in the logical conclusions of an argument.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the same thing as John Stewart brings up in his very famous interview on Crossfire. I remember I was watching that like 2 years ago.
And in effect, also, I often think that Stephen Colbert, when he said, was it Stephen Colbert who said truthiness?
It sounds like something he would say. I think so.
Right. It could have been either one of them. But again, that idea that truth is this truth is very flexible and malleable and
opinion.
It depends on how you present it. Very, very on point for Postman's argument as well.
So I'm not sure. I mean, obviously people still watch television, but I'm not sure if, especially my generation, maybe how much it shapes our discourse about certain topics. But I suppose other mediums have taken over, like, well, obviously social media and the internet at large. How do you think that has evolved, like his ideas? Do they extend to the internet and social media today?
And it's a good question. And it's one I bring to every class. And I ask also all of my students to think, how could we use Postman to think through questions about social media today, right? And so my general response to that is that if we take the idea of media as epistemology, Postman doesn't give us answers, but he gives us a great tool. If we think, what are the ways in which social media shape how we discuss, what we discuss, how we think we identify truth, then the idea of using media as epistemology becomes a great tool for thinking about what are the metaphors of our social media. And so this has been one of the main concerns around trying to address media literacy in this day and age, right? Media literacy used to mean in many ways just literacy. How do you read? How do you engage with a text? But media literacy has now sort of grown to include very important questions on how do we understand and recognize facts? What is truth? How are we defining truth? Where do our most important conversations happen? And in what context are we engaging with them? So our older generations, we can use the popular terms, right? Our baby boomers or over 60 years old generation, right?
They're
still watching television largely. They're our largest population who are still watching the news on TV specifically, right? Most Westerners are watching television, but they're not watching it like we used to. There's a lot of binge watching. There's a lot of episodic sort of People watch television on the internet, so there's a lot of convergence media happening there. So our baby boomers are sort of more traditional in their, they go onto the television to watch the television, they're still watching the news there. And they're the lowest of our social media users. They tend to use social media maybe about 4 hours a week, but they're there. 80% of our baby boomers are there and they're loving it. Right? My mom's on Instagram.
I just think back to all like half or 70% of everything I see on Facebook are probably by baby boomers.
Right. Actually, as a matter of fact, most young people are leaving Facebook. Because all the old people are there. Right? Gen X, I can definitely position myself as a Gen Xer, which is like your 35 to 50 year olds generally, right? Your Gen Xers are actually all over social media. They're on there upwards of 8 hours, and they are primarily using the what we might call the more established platforms and social media sites. So they're on your Facebooks, they're on your Instagrams, they're on your Reddits. They certainly invented 4chan, right? So, but your millennials, are high internet users, slightly less than Gen Xers, actually.
That's surprising, actually.
And then your Gen Zers, and this is sort of your teenage into very young 20s, right? Your Gen Zers are your highest users, but they are not at all consistent. They don't stay with a particular platform. They move as a group. So if your group's on Snapchat, that's where you're going to see them. But if all of a sudden they've moved to WhatsApp, the whole group moves. So they're changing their platforms with the greatest sort of rapidity, right? They rapidly go through their platforms, but they tend to move as large groups, like swarms, you know, from like different platform to different platform. And they prefer their more ethereal platforms. They're not as interested in the old fogey platforms.
When I want to find information about something, maybe politics or something actually important, I tend to go to news websites and stuff like that because I know that that's where I'm going to find good articles. So I don't actually use really social media or TV for that matter to find information. I see it as Postman more as a way of entertainment, but I know that a lot of people get their all their information off social media, if it's news on Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat, whatever. What effect do you think that has on public discourse? Because like everything that is on social media is kind of formatted to be as entertaining and clickable as possible.
Clickbait indeed. Yeah. It has a pretty profound effect, absolutely. And we are seeing that there is a propensity for users, for social media users, to be passive, to receive what comes to them through their social networks, and obviously, and I think many of us understand this now, and through the algorithms, as opposed to being more active pursuers of knowledge. And generally, our Gen Zers are active when it comes to what they're interested in, right? And passive when it comes to, and I'm sure this could probably fit almost all the generations, right?
Yeah.
Less interested, you're going to be more passive. But what becomes important is the fact that we have large groups who are less interested in politics. And so in terms of news, or what types of factual information we discuss as a culture, we are seeing this very passive relationship where, you know, it comes to your feed. And in addition, you generally, many users tend to only actually read the bolded headline and blurb and not even necessarily open up the article itself.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean to suggest that this is brand new. Television is by default can be argued to be a very passive medium, right? Because it's a mass medium, it's one to the many, and you generally don't have nearly as much like dialogic relationship with it, right? Like you aren't co-producing a lot of the content you see on television, whereas social media can be incredibly interactive, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So it's really hard to paint social media with one broad stroke because you have so much co-produced content. You also have these platforms that operate fundamentally differently than the internet. And I think that's the other really important thing to say. And I think Postman, I think that we can use Postman again to think more critically between making distinctions on platform social media and the internet, which we tend to use rather interchangeably, but they're actually function quite differently. The internet is by default a place that you go seek things out from, right? You go to your browser, which gives you this interface so that you can go to places. You surf, you find things on the internet. The application is something you open and the content comes to you. And so they actually function differently. And I think that it's helpful for us to keep those two as somewhat separate now, because as platforms continue to grow, they are tending to dominate the types of activities that people do on their phones, which are growing as the dominant form in which people access digital culture.
So do you think there's a danger to all these big internet companies or social media companies, sorry, because they have since so many, like hundreds of millions of people are on Instagram and billions of people are on Facebook. I'm not sure how many people are on TikTok yet, but they have like such power to kind of shape public discourse because they actually control what you're seeing like on the platform, not in terms of maybe exactly what your friends are posting, but the news that you're getting from that. How does that affect, what effect do you think that has?
It's huge, really, really huge. And this is an area that I'm very concerned with. The internet, as it was sort of first imagined, and even in its early iterations, was always heralded to be this potential great public space in which true democratic interactions and speech could really flourish because people with all different types of thoughts and beliefs and worldviews could come and hash out their different approaches, their different opinions, their different worldviews. And in some spaces, we really do see some of that, right? Yeah. In some community spaces, we really do see that. And I can't even get into outrage and that just now, though that's another great conversation.
Yeah.
Platforms, however, and of course, every individual website may have certain rules or policies, or may have certain types of moderators that enforce, you know, speech restrictions on what can and can't be said or done or shared or da 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 da. And then some are much more lax, as we all know. The thing about platforms is that they really are corporately owned. Corporate interests, money-making spaces that we engage with a false sense of them being true public spaces. So in so much as we might have meaningful democratic conversations, yes, that's possible, absolutely. But at the end of the day, everything that we do on those platforms is making Zuckerberg or, you know, whomever incredibly wealthy, is feeding into an immense database that's collecting our information and selling it for profit. And that at any time, they have real problems with actually enforcing a lot of their policies because they're so big and they don't really have a structure that's suitable for that because they've grown quicker than they've been able to manage their ideas about how to enforce their community standards, as they like to call them. But the truth of the matter is that you can be silenced you can absolutely be shut down with no recourse. It is not truly a public space in that way. And so to get back to your question, right, what effects does this have? They're myriad and they are serious, right? We're so aware after Cambridge Analytica, right, that that our data gets used in ways that we never agreed to, first off, right? That there are a tremendous amount, and it's not hard to buy or populate a tremendous amount of bots on these platforms, on Twitter, on Facebook, and they just go and you can program them to keep repeating certain messages or sharing certain articles. And then it makes it look like, oh, this is so important, or this must be so true. And again, to come back to Postman, right? How do we know what's true? And generally we tend to think that truth is something that's been vetted, right? So we tend to think that if a lot of people are on board, then there must be some element of truth to it. We don't have to always take the whole message without criticism, but we do tend to interact with common ideas with the idea that the more people that agree with it, there must be some nugget of truth to it, right?
Yeah.
So when you purchase 10,000 bots to reproduce, to keep resharing certain articles about vaccines, you are influencing what people begin to think of as valid and vetted information, right? So yes, media literacy is fundamentally important, and Postman would have a lot to say about how truth is dressed on the in social media.
Yeah, I kind of want to segue over into more media literacy. I wrote down some questions about that as well. I took a class with you in media literacy, so I think I've become at least a little bit better at kind of deciphering what I'm seeing on media and social media and everything. Maybe first of all, like, what is media? What does it mean to be media literate?
Oh, okay. That's a great place to start. Okay, I would say that media literacy is our ability to be reasonably informed and educated about how we interact with our media.
How can we become more media literate?
Well, there are multiple things that we can do. From the big to the small. And we can do some of them and all of them, and each one of them helps. The more that we do, the better, right? We can be active when we come across something that we find that we might think is important, whether or not it is trying to incite us to a particular opinion, right? Like anti-vax vaccination literature, right? Mm-hmm. Or whether or not, it's less contentious material, right? Either way, we can become more active. We can follow the link. We can go to the source. We can begin to do very, very basic stuff just at that level. When was it written? Whom was it written by? Do they have a bio? Do they link to an official organization or affiliation, or is this a person's personal belief? Is this a blog or, right? Do they have credentials? Is this someone who might really know what they're talking about? Is this a medical practitioner, for instance, or not, right? We can even look at where the information's coming from, oftentimes because it's coming from someone that we know we trusted all the more, right? Oh, yeah, this came from my really good friend, Deb. I'm going to take this a little bit more seriously, right? But we can backlink some of those things and begin to see, like, do they come from profiles that seem like real people, or are these really shallow profiles?
Yeah.
Recently, do they actually have pictures? Does this sound like a real person, right? In addition to that, we can also snope things. And you don't have to use Snopes specifically. It's a fine first source, right? But you can really start to ask the internet questions about it and see how many hits come up, what types of content you might be able to find about it. I mean, if if you don't want to be duped, you're going to have to do the extra work, right? Yeah. But generally, we're really talking about 3 to 5 minutes, unless all of a sudden you find yourself interested. And then Lord only knows, we've all been lost on the internet for hours.
For sure. It's every time I see someone sharing like a link on Facebook, I if it looks very sketchy, I'll click on it and I'll see that it's complete bullshit. And it's so infuriating because these are like people that I'm very close with that share these links. And it's hard not to kind of lash out on them. Like, do you actually believe this is a good source of information? And I can imagine it's horrible for you with all your like professor and academic friends when you share something. They're probably all of them are going to come back to you unless the source is 100% true and accurate.
Yes. Well, my personal social media spaces tend to be very heavy with academic colleagues. And let me tell you, I think we've all fallen prey to sharing something at least one point or a dozen that maybe wasn't accurate or recent. And wow, will your colleagues totally take you to task on that? And I really appreciate it. And it's a little embarrassing, not going to lie, right? But also, how do we engage with our friends and family, right? Who, first of all, maybe don't appreciate that type of taking to task. Not everybody.
Yeah, for sure. Similarly. I just try to like sneak into conversations sometimes. I saw you share that article. It's great. Like, try to bring it up some way so it's not hurtful. I think everyone needs to take the responsibility to educate themselves more, just because media is such a big part of our lives. And so, yeah, it's just a big deal, big part of our lives. But I also think that the companies, the big media companies, also need to be more responsible in developing ways and, I guess, changing their policies maybe to make it easier for people to decipher what is true and what is not as well. But I just wanted to ask you if there is a way to develop a more kind of responsible media climate.
Yes. Yes, there absolutely is. The number one way that I would advocate is that we have to pressure social media companies to open up their moderating practices to include. They need to be more inclusive in this process. They need to be both more transparent, but they also need to build better liaisons with users. And here I want to be a little bit careful what I'm saying here. Users can report content all the time, and that's not quite what I'm talking about, because unfortunately, that can be used a little vindictively, like, I didn't like what you said, so I'm going to report it, or, you know, it can be very uneven, right? Like, oh, I'm going to report that breastfeeding because this level of nudity offends me, but I'm perfectly comfortable over here with this, you know, much more, you know, sexy content because that appeals to me, right? So user reporting can be pretty uneven, but the way in which and the community standards that these platforms supposedly support should be community driven, right? So that's one task of it. There's a dark side to social media that doesn't get discussed a whole lot, and that is that the understaffed moderators that do exist actually have a pretty hard job of sifting through very disturbing content that we're very lucky very rarely reaches us. And it psychologically affects them. And there's more and more research coming out all the time on the impact of this sort of traumatic having to really go through very disturbing content day in and day out.
Yeah, it's not a job I'd like to have.
No, and a lot of these companies don't really provide the type of support, psychological, emotional, but even just bright and airy workspaces, better conditions where you can get up and take a break all the time. right? They're very, they're from everything we're learning, they're really terrible conditions that they're working in. And so that needs to be addressed too. There should be more moderators. They should have the kinds of resources that we really must provide for them for doing this kind of work that's really hard on the soul, you know? So there's lots of ways in which these companies can and should be taking far more responsible measures. And then Facebook has come out and tried to say, like, okay, we're gonna implement this new system where we're gonna let you know if something's fake news because we were caught and we realized that we allowed a tremendous amount of fake news to circulate when we understood and knew that it wasn't reliable. And then even there, they've retracted a lot of those standards already.
Yeah, I don't want to get in too much about that because that's for another 4 hours of podcasting. But yes. I heard somewhere yesterday, I definitely did not double check this, but I heard that Twitter is going to ban all political advertising starting, I think, now or like next week or something.
Oh, I didn't come across that.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, is that a good idea? And is that something other companies should implement as well?
What a good question. I don't know if I have a specific yes or no answer for you at this point. I can see the merit in a large company saying we don't know a better way to handle this level of content, so we're just going to nix it.
Yeah.
And maybe that will alleviate some of our problems. I suspect social media is probably never going to find easy solutions because they are dealing with the content of human beings who have so many diverse goals in mind, right? And so again, I think the best thing that I can say is that these companies really ought to become public companies with far more community engagement at the highest level of how these decisions get made, because they became popular in ways that no one anticipated, certainly not even Mark, to say the least, right? They grew rapidly and appealed to something within us that clearly we want. So I don't think we're all going to just walk away. I certainly have tons of colleagues who regularly discuss openly on Facebook, like, do we walk away from this platform knowing everything that we know? But they've become bigger than the individuals themselves, mm-hmm. right? No one wants to walk away from that third cousin you don't get to see often that lives in insert, not nearby geographical location.
FOMO.
Exactly. And so, and also, yeah, FOMO, absolutely. But just also a desire to remain connected to people in easy, easy, low barrier ways, right? So I don't think that social media, I don't think we're just going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
But I do believe that we have far greater of a responsibility, and I would like to see more people involved in absolutely demanding and asserting that we have more engagement and contributions in how they function.
Yeah, I have very strong opinions about a lot of the ways the companies deal with their companies, basically. But I don't want to bash out on social media too much because it's also an incredible tool for a lot of people. And just like your forthcoming book is about, it provides people with tools to resistance, and it gives people a sense of community. There are definitely a lot of positives that in these discussions maybe are forgotten, but I think it's important to point out. But when is your book coming out, by the way, and what's it called?
So the book is now anticipated to come out in June 2020, which is a little delay, but suddenly moving countries does provide a small hiccup to your regular workflow.
No way.
And this will be our co-authored book together called Technologies of Resistance. So it'll be about the ways in which activism happens online.
Nice. I'm very excited. I'm gonna read it as soon as it comes out, and I'm sure I've read some of your other work, although not all of it because it is very long, and there's a lot of long and difficult words in it. But I'm very excited about the book, and I just wish you the best with everything. I know it's gonna be great.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Do you have any last things you'd like to say? Anything I forgot to ask, or any last piece of advice for how we should think about media?
Well, I think that we need to really embrace our individual responsibilities in being literate, but we need to come together and really work at developing and creating, developing, and distributing sort of collective media literacies together, right? So I think that we have to start with our own responsibility, but it can't stop there, or else we've really failed at reaching out those with less resources than ourselves, right? So it's really got to be some community coming together. So we do really love to think of and sort of reference the internet as this global village. And so while we need to start with our own individual responsibility for media literacy, it cannot stop there. It really can, that cannot be the only effort we make, because we're talking about in a diverse world with a tremendous amount of people with different levels of all different types of literacy, but also resources and access to resources. And so I think the most important thing is that we really have to start working in earnest together on developing community literacy tools.
I feel like every time I talk to you or after every one of your classes, I just need to lie down for a couple of hours and just process. But seriously, thank you so much for coming on. It's always great to talk to you, and I'll hope you come back when your book is out to talk more about your research.
Well, I look forward to it, Adam.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Hopefully, there'll be a little book tour, in which case I hope to be going through lots of different places, and maybe I'll see you in Scandinavia or America.
Yeah, and
And
hopefully I'll have some more listeners by then, so you can come back and do some marketing.
maybe I'll have more to say about social media memes by then.
Yes, I really hope so. But again, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Bye.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you.